and Dean Martin singing, "That's Amore." Waitresses circulated with steins of beer and heaped platters of what had to be fried lobster pickens. And there were rising rafters of blue smoke, of course. In 1958, there's always smoke. "See you glancing at that table back there," a voice said at my elbow. I had been at the lamplighter long enough to have ordered my second beer and a junior platter of lobster pickens. I figured if I didn't at least try them, I'd always wonder. I looked around and saw a small man with slicked back hair, a round face, and lively black eyes. He looked like a cheerful chipmunk. He grinned at me and stuck out a child-sized hand. On his forearm, a bare-breasted mermaid flapped her flippy tail and winked one eye. "Charles Freddy, but you can call me Chaz. Everyone does." I shook. "George Amberson, but you can call me George. Everyone does that, too." He laughed. So did I. It's considered bad form to laugh at your own jokes, especially when they're teensy ones. But some people are so engaging, they never have to laugh alone. Chaz Fratty was one of those. The waitress brought him a beer, and he raised it. "Here's to you, George." "I'll drink to that," I said, and clicked the rim of my glass against his. "Anybody you know?" he asked, looking at the big rear table in the back bar mirror. "Nope." I wiped foam from my upper lip. "They just seem to be having more fun than anybody else in the place, that's all." Chaz smiled. "That's Tony Trecker's table. Might as well have his name engraved on it. Tony and his brother Phil own a freight hauling company. They also own more acres in this town, and the towns around it, than Cotter has liver pills. Phil don't show up here much. He's mostly on the road, but Tony don't miss many Friday or Saturday nights. Has lots of friends, too. They always have a good time, but nobody makes a party go like Frank Dunning. He's the guy telling jokes. Everybody likes old Tones, but they love Frankie." "You sound like you know them all." "For years, know most of the people in Derry. But I don't know you." "That's because I just got here. I'm in real estate." "Business real estate, I take it?" "You take it right." The waitress deposited my lobster pickens and hustled away. The heap on the platter looked like roadkill, but it smelled terrific and tasted better. Probably a billion grams of cholesterol in every bite, but in 1958, nobody worries about that, which is restful. "Help me with this," I said. "Nope, they're all yours. You out of Boston? New York?" I shrugged and he laughed. "Playing it cagey, huh? Don't blame you, cuz. Loose lips sink ships. But I have a pretty good idea what you're up to." I paused with a forkful of lobster pickens halfway to my mouth. It was warm in the lamplighter, but I felt suddenly chilly. "Is that so?" He leaned close. I could smell Vitalis on his slicked back hair and Sensen on his breath. "If I said possible mall sight, would that be a bingo?" I felt a gust of relief. The idea that I was in Derry looking for a place to put a shopping mall had never crossed my mind, but it was a good one. I dropped Chaz Fratty a wink. "Can't say." "No, no, course you couldn't. Business is as business does, I always say. We'll drop the subject. But if you'd ever consider letting one of the local yokels in on a good thing, I'd love to listen. And just to show you that my heart is in the right place, I'll give you a little tip. If you haven't checked out the old Kitchener Ironworks yet, you ought to. Perfect spot. And malls? Do you know what malls are, my son?" "The wave of the future," I said. He pointed a finger at me like a gun and winked. I laughed again. I just couldn't help it. Part of it was the simple relief of finding out that not every grown-up in Derry had forgotten how to be friendly to a stranger. "Hole in one." "And who owns the land the old Kitchener Ironworks sits on, Chaz? The Tracker brothers, I suppose?" I said they own most of the land around here, not all of it. He looked down at the mermaid. Millie, should I tell George who owns that prime business-owned real estate only 2 miles from the center of this metropolis? Millie wagged her scaly tail and jiggled her teacup breasts. Chess Fratty didn't clench his hand into a fist to make this happen. The muscles in his forearm seemed to move on their own. It was a good trick. I wondered if he also pulled rabbits out of hats. All right, dear. He looked up at me again. Actually, that would be yours truly. I buy the best and let the Tracker Brothers have the rest. Business is as business does. May I give you my card, George? Absolutely. He did. The card simply said Charles Chaz Fratty. Buy, sell, trade. I tucked it into my shirt pocket. If you know all those people and they know you, why aren't you over there? Instead of sitting at the bar with the new kid on the block, I asked. He looked surprised, then amused all over again. Was you born in a trunk and then threw off a train, cuz? Just new in town. Haven't learned the ropes. Don't hold it against me. Never would. They do business with me because I own half this town's motor courts, both downtown movie theaters and the drive-in, one of the banks, and all of the pawn shops in eastern and central Maine. But they don't eat with me, or drink with me, or invite me into their homes, or their country club, because I'm a member of the tribe. You lost me. I'm a Jew, cuz. He saw my expression and grinned. You didn't know. Even when I wouldn't eat any of your lobster, you didn't know. I'm touched. I'm just trying to figure out why it should make a difference, I said. He laughed as though this were the best joke he'd heard all year. Then you was born under a cabbage leaf, instead of in a trunk. In the mirror, Frank Dunning was talking. Tony Tracker and his friends were listening with big grins on their faces. When they exploded into bull roars of laughter, I wondered if it had been the one about the three jigs stuck in the elevator. Or maybe something even more amusing and satiric. 3 yids on a golf course, maybe. Chaz saw me looking. Frank knows how to make a party go all right. You know where he works? No, you're new in town, I forgot. Center Street Market. He's the head butcher. Also half owner, although he don't advertise it. You know what? He's half the reason that place stands up and makes a profit. Draws the ladies like bees to honey. Does he now? Yep. And the men like him, too. That's not always the case. Fellas don't always like a ladies' man. That made me think of my ex-wife's fierce Johnny Depp fixation. But it's not like the old days, when he'd drink with them until closing, then play poker with them down at the freight depot until the crack of dawn. These days, he'll have one beer, maybe two. And then he's out the door. You watch. It was a behavior pattern I knew about firsthand, from Christie's sporadic efforts to control her booze intake rather than stop altogether. It would work for a while, but sooner or later she always went off the deep end. Drinking problem? I asked. Don't know about that, but he sure got a temper problem. He looked down at the tattoo on his forearm. Millie, you ever notice how many funny fellas have got a mean streak? Millie flipped her tail. Chaz looked at me solemnly. See, the women always know. He snuck a lobster pickin' and shot his eyes comically from side to side. He was a very amusing fellow, and it never crossed my mind that he was anything other than what he claimed to be. But, as Chaz himself had implied, I was a bit on the naive side, certainly for Derry. Don't tell Rabbi Snores a lot. Your secret's safe with me. By the way the men at the tracker table were leaning toward Frank, he had launched into another joke. He was the kind of man who talked a lot with his hands. They were big hands. It was easy to imagine one of them holding the haft of a craftsman hammer. He ripped and roared something terrible back in high school, Chaz said. You're looking at a guy who knows. because I went to the old county consolidated with him. But I mostly kept out of his way. Suspensions, left and right, always for fighting. He was supposed to go to the University of Maine, but he got a girl pregnant and ended up getting married instead. After a year or two of it, she collected the baby and scrammed. Probably a smart idea, the way he was then. Frankie was the kind of guy. Fighting the Germans or the Japs probably would have been good for him. Get all that mad out, you know. But he came up 4F. I never heard why. Flat feet? Heart murmur? The high blood? No way of telling. But you probably don't want to hear all this old gossip. I do, I said. It's interesting. It sure was. I'd come into the lamplighter to wet my whistle and had stumbled into a gold mine instead. Have another lobster picking. Twist my arm, he said, and popped one into his mouth. He jerked a thumb at the mirror as he chewed. And why shouldn't I? Just look at those guys back there. Half of them Catholics and still chowing up on burgers and BLTs and sausage subs on Friday. Who can make sense of religion, cuz? You got me, I said. I'm a lapsed Methodist. Guess Mr. Dunning never got that college education, huh? Nope. By the time his first wife done her midnight flit, he was getting a graduate degree in cutting meat. And he was good at it. Got into some more trouble, and yeah, drinking was somewhat involved from what I heard. People gossip terrible, you know, and a man who owns pawn shops hears it all. So, Mr. Volander, him who owned the market back in those days, he sat down and had a Dutch uncle talk with old Frankie. Chaz shook his head and picked another pickin'. If Benny Volander had ever known Frankie Dunning was going to own half the place by the time that Korea shit was over, he probably would have had a brain hemorrhage. Good thing we can't see the future, isn't it? That would complicate things, all right. Chaz was warming to his story, and when I told the waitress to bring another couple of beers, he didn't tell her no. Benny Volander said Frankie was the best prentice butcher he'd ever had, but if he got in any more trouble with the cops, fighting if anyone farted sideways, in other words, he'd have to let him go. A word to the wise is sufficient, they say, and Frankie straightened up. Divorced that first wife of his on grounds of desertion, after she was gone a year or two, then remarried not long after. The war was going full steam by then, and he could have had his pick of the ladies. He has that charm, you know, and most of the competition was overseas anyway. But he settled on Doris McKinney. Lovely girl she was. And still is, I'm sure. Absolutely, cuz. Pretty as a picture. They've got 3 or 4 kids, nice family. Chaz leaned close again. But Frankie still loses his temper now and then. And he must have lost it at her last spring, because she turned up at church with bruises on her face, and a week later he was out the door. He's living in a rooming house as close as he could get to the old homestead, hoping she'll take him back, I imagine. And sooner or later she will. He's got that charming way of, whoops, looky there. What did I tell you? He's a gone cat. Dunning was getting up. The other men were bellowing for him to sit back down, but he was shaking his head and pointing to his watch. He tipped the last swallow of his beer down his throat, then bent and kissed one man's bald head. This brought a room-shaking roar of approval, and Dunning surfed on it toward the door. He slapped Chaz on the back as he went by and said, "Keep that nose clean, Chazzy. It's too long to get dirty." Then he was gone. Chaz looked at me. He was giving me the cheerful chipmunk grin, but his eyes weren't smiling. "Ain't he a card?" "Sure," I said. I'm one of those people who doesn't really know what he thinks until he writes it down. So I spent most of that weekend making notes about what I'd seen in Derry, what I'd done, and what I planned to do. They expanded into an explanation of how I'd gotten to Derry in the first place, and by Sunday I realized that I'd started a job that was too big for a pocket notebook and ballpoint pen. On Monday I went out and bought a portable typewriter. My intention had been to go to the local business supply store, but then I saw Chaz Fratty's card on the kitchen table and went there instead. It was on East Side Drive, a pawn shop almost as big as a department store. The three gold balls were over the door, as was traditional, but there was something else as well, a plaster mermaid, flapping her flippy tail and winking one eye. This one, being out in public, was wearing a bra top. Fratty himself was not in evidence, but I got a terrific Smith Corona for $12. I told the clerk to tell Mr. Fratty that George, the real estate guy, had been in. "Happy to do it, sir. Would you like to leave your card?" Shit, I'd have to have some of those printed. Which meant a visit to Dairy Business Supply after all. "Left them in my other suit coat," I said, "but I think he'll remember me. We had a drink at the Lamplighter." That afternoon, I began expanding my notes. I got used to the planes coming in for a landing directly over my head. I arranged for newspaper and milk delivery, thick glass bottles brought right to your doorstep. Like the root beer Frank Ancietti had served me on my first jaunt into 1958, the milk tasted incredibly full and rich. The cream was even better. I didn't know if artificial creamers had been invented yet and had no intention of finding out, not with this stuff around. The days slipped by. I read Al Templeton's notes on Oswald until I could have quoted long passages by heart. I visited the library and read about the murders and the disappearances that had plagued Derry in 1957 and 1958. I looked for stories about Frank Dunning and his famous bad temper, but found none. If he had ever been arrested, the story hadn't made it into the newspaper's police beat column, which was good-sized on most days and usually expanded to a full page on Mondays when it contained a full summary of the weekend's didos, most of which happened after the bars closed. The only story I found about the janitor's father concerned a 1955 charity drive. The Center Street Market had contributed 10% of their profits that fall to the Red Cross to help out after Hurricanes Connie and Diane slammed into the East Coast, killing 200 and causing extensive flood damage in New England. There was a picture of Harry's father handing an oversized check to the regional head of the Red Cross. Dunning was flashing that movie star smile. I made no more shopping trips to the Center Street Market, but on two weekends, the last in September and the first in October, I followed Derry's favorite butcher after he finished his half-day Saturday stint behind the meat counter. I rented nondescript Hertz Chevrolets from the airport for this chore. The Sunliner, I felt, was a little too conspicuous for shadowing. On the first Saturday afternoon, he went to a brewer flea market in a Pontiac he kept in a downtown pay-by-the-month garage and rarely used during the work week. On the following Sunday, he drove to his house on Cosset Street, collected his kids, and took them to a Disney double feature at the Aladdin. Even at a distance, Troy, the eldest, looked bored out of his mind, both going into the theater and coming out. Dunning didn't enter the house for either the pickup or the drop-off. He honked for the kids when he arrived and let them off at the curb when they came back, watching until all four were inside. He didn't drive off immediately even then, only sat behind the wheel of the idling Bonneville, smoking a cigarette. Maybe hoping the lovely Doris might want to come out and talk? When he was sure she wouldn't, he used a neighbor's driveway to turn around in and sped off, squealing his tires hard enough to send up little splurts of blue smoke. I slumped in the seat of my rental, but I needn't have bothered. He never looked in my direction as he passed, and when he was a good distance down Wycham Street, I followed along after. He returned his car to the garage where he kept it, went to the Lamplighter for a single beer at the nearly deserted bar, then trudged back to Edna Price's rooms on Charity Avenue with his head down. The following Saturday, October 4th, he collected his kids and took them to the football game at the University of Maine in Orono, some 30 miles away. I parked on Stillwater Avenue and waited for the game to be over. On the way back, they stopped at the 95er for dinner. I parked at the far end of the parking lot and waited for them to come out. reflecting that the life of a private eye must be a boring one, no matter what the movies would have us believe. When Dunning delivered his children back home, dusk was creeping over Cossett Street. Troy had clearly enjoyed football more than the adventures of Cinderella. He exited his father's Pontiac grinning and waving a black bear's pennant. Tugga and Harry also had pennants and also seemed energized. Ellen? Not so much. She was fast asleep. Dunning carried her to the door of the house in his arms. This time, Mrs. Dunning made a brief appearance, just long enough to take the little girl into her own arms. Dunning said something to Doris. Her reply didn't seem to please him. The distance was too great to read his expression, but he was wagging a finger at her as he spoke. She listened, shook her head, turned, and went inside. He stood there a moment or two, then took off his hat and slapped it against his leg. All interesting and instructive of the relationship, but no help otherwise. Not what I was looking for. I got that the following day. I had decided to make only two reconnaissance passes that Sunday, feeling that even in a dark brown rental unit that almost faded into the landscape, more would be risking notice. I saw nothing on the first one and figured he was probably in for the day, and why not? The weather had turned gray and drizzly. He was probably watching sports on TV with the rest of the boarders, all of them smoking up a storm in the parlor. But I was wrong. Just as I turned onto Witcham for my second pass, I saw him walking toward downtown, today dressed in blue jeans, a windbreaker, and a wide-brimmed waterproof hat. I drove past him and parked on Main Street, about a block up from the garage he used. 20 minutes later, I was following him out of town to the west. Traffic was light, and I kept well back. His destination turned out to be Longview Cemetery, 2 miles past the Dairy Drive-In. He stopped at a flower stand across from it, and as I drove by, I saw him buying 2 baskets of fall flowers from an old lady who held a big black umbrella over both of them during the transaction. I watched in my rearview mirror as he put the flowers on the passenger seat of his car, got back in, and drove up the cemetery's access road. I turned around and drove back to Longview. This was taking a risk, but I had to chance it, because this looked good. The parking lot was empty, except for 2 pickups loaded with groundkeeping equipment under tarps and a dinged-up old payloader that looked like war surplus. No sign of Dunning's Pontiac. I drove across the lot toward the gravel lane leading into the cemetery itself, which was huge, sprawling over as many as 12 hilly acres. In the cemetery proper, smaller lanes split off from the main one. Ground fog was rising up from the dips and valleys, and the drizzle was thickening into rain. Not a good day for visiting the dear departed, all in all, and Dunning had the place to himself. His Pontiac, parked halfway up a hill on one of the feeder lanes, was easy to spot. He was placing the flower baskets before 2 side-by-side graves. His parents, I assumed, but I didn't really care. I turned my car around and left him to it. By the time I got back to my Harris Avenue apartment, that fall's first hard rain was pounding the city. Downtown, the canal would be roaring, and the peculiar thrumming that came up through the concrete in the low town would be more noticeable than ever. Indian summer seemed to be over. I didn't care about that either. I opened my notebook, flipped almost to the end before I found a blank page, and wrote October 5th, 3:45 p.m., Dunning to Longview Sem, puts flowers on parents, graves, rain. I had what I wanted. Chapter 8. In the weeks before Halloween, Mr. George Amberson inspected almost every commercial-zoned piece of property in Derry and the surrounding towns. I knew better than to believe that I'd ever be accepted as a townie on short notice, but I wanted to get the locals accustomed to the sight of my sporty red Sunliner convertible, Just part of the scenery. There goes that real estate fella. Been here almost a month now. If he knows what he's doing, there might be some money in it for someone. When people asked me what I was looking for, I'd give a wink and a smile. When people asked me how long I'd be staying, I told them it was hard to say. I learned the geography of the town, and I began to learn the verbal geography of 1958. I learned, for instance, that the war meant World War II. The conflict meant Korea. Both were over and good riddance. People worried about Russia and the so-called missile gap, but not too much. People worried about juvenile delinquency, but not too much. There was a recession, but people had seen worse. When you bargained with someone, it was absolutely okay to say that you jewed them down or got gypped. Penny candy included dots, wax lips, and nigger babies. In the South, Jim Crow ruled. In Moscow, Nikita Khrushchev bellowed threats. In Washington, President Eisenhower droned good cheer. I made a point of checking out the defunct Kitchener Ironworks not long after speaking with Ches Fratty. It was in a large, overgrown stretch of empty to the north of town, and yes, it would be the perfect spot for a shopping mall once the extension of the mile-a-minute highway reached it. But on the day I visited, leaving my car and walking when the road turned to axle-smashing rubble, it could have been the ruin of an ancient civilization. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Heaps of brick and rusty chunks of old machinery poked out of the high grass. In the middle was a long, collapsed ceramic smokestack, its sides blackened by soot, its huge bore full of darkness. If I'd lowered my head and hunched over, I could have walked into it, and I am not a short man. I saw a lot of Derry in those weeks before Halloween, and I felt a lot of Derry. Long-time residents were pleasant to me, but with one exception, never chummy. Chaz Fratty was that exception, and in retrospect, I guess his unprompted revelation should have struck me as odd. But I had a great many things on my mind, and Fratty didn't seem all that important. I thought, sometimes you just meet a friendly guy, that's all, and let it go at that. Certainly, I had no idea that a man named Bill Turkett had put Fratty up to it. Bill Turkett, a.k.a. No Suspenders. Bevy from the Levee had said she thought the bad times in Derry were over. But the more of it I saw, and the more I felt, that especially, the more I came to believe that Derry wasn't like other places. Derry wasn't right. At first I tried to tell myself that it was me, not the town. I was a man out of joint, a temporal Bedouin, and any place would have felt a little strange to me, a little skewed, like the cities that seem so much like bad dreams in those strange Paul Bowles novels. This was persuasive at first, but as the days passed and I continued to explore my new environment, it became less so. I even began to question Beverly Marsh's assertion that the bad times were over, and imagined on nights when I couldn't sleep, and there were quite a few of those, that she questioned it herself. Hadn't I glimpsed a seed of doubt in her eyes? The look of someone who doesn't quite believe but wants to, maybe even needs to? Something wrong, something bad. Certain empty houses that seemed to stare like the faces of people suffering from terrible mental illness. An empty barn on the outskirts of town, the hayloft door swinging slowly open and closed on rusty hinges, first disclosing darkness, then hiding it, then disclosing it again. A splintered fence on Cosset Street, just a block away from the house where Mrs. Dunning and her children lived. To me, that fence looked as if something or someone had been hurled through it and into the barrens below. An empty playground with the roundy-round slowly spinning, even though there were no kids to push it and no appreciable wind to turn it. It screamed on its hidden bearings as it moved. One day, I saw a roughly carved Jesus go floating down the canal and into the tunnel that ran beneath Canal Street. It was 3 feet long. The teeth peeped from lips parted in a snarling grin. A crown of thorns, jauntily askew, circled the forehead. Bloody tears had been painted below the thing's weird white eyes. It looked like a juju fetish. On the so-called kissing bridge in Bassey Park, amid the declarations of school spirit and undying love, someone had carved the words, "I will kill my mother soon." And below it, someone had added, "Not soon enough, she's full of disease." One afternoon, while walking on the east side of the barrens, I heard a terrible squealing and looked up to see the silhouette of a thin man standing on the GS and WM railroad trestle not far away. A stick rose and fell in his hand. He was beating something. The squealing stopped, and I thought, it was a dog, and he's finished with it. He took it out there on a rope leash and beat it until it was dead. There was no way I could have known such a thing, of course, and yet I did. I was sure then, and I am now. Something wrong. Something bad. Do any of those things bear on the story I'm telling? The story of the janitor's father and of Lee Harvey Oswald? He of the smirky little I-know-a-secret smile and gray eyes that would never quite meet yours? I don't know for sure, but I can tell you one more thing. There was something inside that fallen chimney at the Kitchener Ironworks. I don't know what, and I don't want to know. But at the mouth of the thing, I saw a heap of gnawed bones and a tiny chewed collar with a bell on it. A collar that had surely belonged to some child's beloved kitten. And from inside the pipe, deep in that oversized bore, something moved and shuffled. "Come in and see," that something seemed to whisper in my head. "Never mind all the rest of it, Jake. Come in and see. Come in and visit. Time doesn't matter in here. In here, time just floats away. You know you want to. You know you're curious. Maybe it's even another rabbit hole. Another portal." Maybe it was, but I don't think so. I think it was dairy in there. Everything that was wrong with it, everything that was askew, hiding in that pipe. Hibernating, letting people believe the bad times were over, waiting for them to relax and forget there had ever been bad times at all. I left in a hurry, and to that part of Derry, I never went back. One day in the second week of October, by then the oaks and elms on Cosset Street were a riot of gold and red, I once more visited the defunct West Side Wreck. No self-respecting real estate bounty hunter would fail to fully investigate the possibilities of such a prime site, and I asked several people on the street what it was like inside. The door was padlocked, of course. And when it had closed. One of the people I spoke to was Doris Dunning. "Pretty as a picture," Chaz Fratty had said. A generally meaningless cliché, but true in this case. The years had put fine lines around her eyes and deeper ones at the corners of her mouth, but she had exquisite skin and a terrific full-breasted figure. In 1958, the heyday of Jane Mansfield, full breasts are considered attractive rather than embarrassing. We spoke on the stoop. To invite me in with the house empty and the kids at school would have been improper, and no doubt the subject of neighborly gossip, especially with her husband living out. She had a dust rag in one hand and a cigarette in the other. There was a bottle of furniture polish poking out of her apron pocket. Like most folks in Derry, she was polite but distant. Yes, she said. When it was still up and running, Westside Rec had been a fine facility for the kiddos. It was so nice to have a place like that close by where they could go after school and race around to their heart's content. She could see the playground and the basketball court from her kitchen window, and it was very sad to see them empty. She said she thought the rec had been closed in a round of budget cuts, but the way her eyes shifted and her mouth tucked in suggested something else to me, that it had been closed during the round of child murders and disappearances. Budget concerns might have been secondary. I thanked her and handed her one of my recently printed business cards. She took it, gave me a distracted smile, and closed the door. It was a gentle close, not a slam, but I heard a rattle from behind it and knew she was putting on the chain. I thought the wreck might do for my purposes when Halloween came. Although I didn't completely love it, I anticipated no problems getting inside, and one of the front windows would give me a fine view of the street. Dunning might come in his car rather than on foot. But I knew what it looked like. It would be after dark, according to Harry's essay, but there were streetlights. Of course, that visibility thing cut both ways. Unless he was totally fixated on what he'd come to do, Dunning would almost certainly see me running at him. I had the pistol, but it was only dead accurate up to 15 yards. I'd need to be even closer before I dared risk a shot, because on Halloween night Cosset Street was sure to be alive with pint-sized ghosts and goblins. Yet I couldn't wait until he actually got in the house before breaking cover, because according to the essay, Doris Dunning's estranged husband had gone to work right away. By the time Harry came out of the bathroom, all of them were down and all but Ellen were dead. If I waited, I was apt to see what Harry had seen, his mother's brains soaking into the couch. I hadn't traveled across more than half a century to save just one of them. And so what if he saw me coming? I was the man with a gun, he was the man with a hammer, probably filched from the tool drawer at his boarding house. If he ran at me, that would be good. I'd be like a rodeo clown distracting the bull. I'd caper and yell until he got in range, then put two in his chest. Assuming I was able to pull the trigger, that was. And assuming the gun worked, I'd test-fired it in a gravel pit on the outskirts of town, and it seemed fine. But the past is obdurate. It doesn't want to change. Upon further consideration, I thought there might be an even better location for my Halloween night stakeout. I'd need a little luck, but maybe not too much. "God knows there's plenty for sale in these parts," bartender Fred Toomey had said on my first night in Derry. My explorations had borne that out, in the wake of the murders and the big flood of 57, don't forget that. It seemed that half the town was for sale. In a less standoffish burg, a supposed real estate buyer like myself probably would have been given a key to the city and a wild weekend with Miss Derry by now. One street I hadn't checked out was Wymore Lane, a block south of Cosset Street. That meant the Wymore backyards would abut on Cosset backyards. It couldn't hurt to check. Though 206 Wymore, the house directly behind the Dunnings, was occupied, the one next to it on the left, 202, looked like an answered prayer. The gray paint was fresh, and the shingles were new, but the shutters were closed up tight. On the freshly raked lawn was a yellow and green sign I'd seen all over town, "For Sale by Derry Home Real Estate Specialists." This one invited me to call specialist Keith Haney and discuss financing. I had no intention of doing that, but I parked my Sunliner in the newly asphalted driveway. Someone was going all out to sell this one, and walked into the backyard, head up, shoulders back, big as Billy be damned. I had discovered many things while exploring my new environment, and one of them was that if you acted like you belonged in a certain place, people thought you did. The backyard was nicely mowed, the leaves raked away to showcase the velvety green. A push lawnmower had been stored under the garage overhang with a swatch of green tarpaulin tucked neatly over the rotary blades. Beside the cellar bulkhead was a doghouse with a sign on it that showed Keith Haney at his don't-miss-a-trick best. "Your pooch belongs here." Inside was a pile of unused leaf bags with a garden trowel and a pair of hedge clippers to hold them down. In 2011, the tools would have been locked away. In 1958, someone had taken care to see they were out of the rain and called it good. I was sure the house was locked, but that was okay. I had no interest in breaking and entering. At the far end of 202 Wymore's backyard was a hedge about 6 feet tall. Not quite as tall as I was, in other words, and although it was luxuriant, a man could force his way through easily enough, if he didn't mind a few scratches. Best of all, when I walked down to the far right corner, which was behind the garage, I was able to look on a diagonal into the backyard of the Dunning house. I saw two bicycles. One was a boy's Schwinn, leaning on its kickstand. The other, lying on its side like a dead pony, was Ellen Dunning's. There was no mistaking the training wheels. There was also a litter of toys. One of them was Harry Dunning's Daisy air rifle. If you've ever acted in an amateur stage company or directed student theatricals, which I had several times while at LHS, you'll know what the days leading up to Halloween were like for me. At first, rehearsals have a lazy feel. There's improvisation, joking, horseplay, and a good deal of flirting as sexual polarities are established. If someone flubs a line or misses a cue in those early rehearsals, it's an occasion for laughter. If an actor shows up 15 minutes late, he or she might get a mild reprimand, but probably nothing more. Then opening night begins to seem like an actual possibility instead of a foolish dream. Improv falls away, so does the horseplay, and although the jokes remain, the laughter that greets them has a nervous energy that was missing before. Flubbed lines and missed cues begin to seem exasperating rather than amusing. An actor arriving late for rehearsal once the sets are up and opening night is only days away is apt to get a serious reaming from the director. The big night comes. The actors put on their costumes and makeup. Some are outright terrified. All feel not quite prepared. Soon, they will have to face a room full of people who have come to see them strut their stuff. What seemed distant in the days of bare stage blocking has come, after all. And before the curtain goes up, some Hamlet, Willie Loman, or Blanche DuBois will have to rush into the nearest bathroom and be sick. It never fails. Trust me on the sickness part. I know. In the small hours of Halloween morning, I found myself not in Derry, but on the ocean. A stormy ocean. I was clinging to the rail of a large vessel, a yacht, I think, that was on the verge of foundering. Rain, driven by a howling gale, was sheeting into my face. Huge waves, black at their bases and a curdled, foamy green on top, rushed toward me. The yacht rose, twisted, then plummeted down again with a wild corkscrewing motion. I woke from this dream with my heart pounding and my hands still curled from trying to hold onto the rail my brain had dreamed up. Only it wasn't just my brain, because the bed was still going up and down. My stomach seemed to have come unmoored from the muscles that were supposed to hold it in place. At such moments, the body is almost always wiser than the brain. I threw back the covers and sprinted for the bathroom, kicking over the hateful yellow chair as I sped through the kitchen. My toes would be sore later, but right then I barely felt it. I tried to lock my throat shut, but only partially succeeded. I could hear a weird sound seeping through it and into my mouth. Oh, was what it sounded like. My stomach was the yacht, first rising and then taking those horrible corkscrew drops. I fell on my knees in front of the toilet and threw up my dinner. Next came lunch and yesterday's breakfast. Oh, God, ham and eggs. At the thought of all that shining grease, I retched again. There was a pause, and then what felt like everything I'd eaten for the last week left the building. Just as I began to hope it was over, my bowels gave a terrible liquid wrench. I stumbled to my feet, batted down the toilet ring, and managed to sit before everything fell out in a watery splat. But no, not everything, not yet. My stomach took another giddy heave just as my bowels went to work again. There was only one thing to do, and I did it. Leaned forward and vomited into the sink. It went on like that until noon of Halloween Day. By then, both my ejection ports were producing nothing but watery gruel. Each time I threw up, each time my bowels cramped, I thought the same thing. The past does not want to be changed. The past is obdurate. But when Frank Dunning arrived tonight, I meant to be there. Even if I was still heaving and shitting gray water, I meant to be there. Even if it killed me, I meant to be there. Mr. Norbit Keene, proprietor of the Center Street Drug, was behind the counter when I came in on that Friday afternoon. The wooden paddle fan over his head lifted what remained of his hair in a wavery dance, cobwebs in a summer breeze. Just looking at that made my abused stomach give another warning lurch. He was skinny inside his white cotton smock, almost emaciated, and when he saw me coming, his pale lips creased in a smile. "You look a little under the weather, my friend."
"Kaopectate,"
I said in a hoarse voice that didn't sound like my own.
"Do you have it?"
Wondering if it had even been invented yet. "Are we suffering a little touch of the bug?" The overhead light caught in the lenses of his small rimless spectacles and skated around when he moved his head. Like butter across a skillet, I thought, and at that my stomach gave another lunge.
"It's been going around town. You're in for a nasty 24 hours, I'm afraid. Probably a germ. You may have used a public convenience and forgotten to wash your hands. So many people are lazy about—"
"Do you have Kaopectate or not?"
"Of course. Second aisle."
"Continence pants. What about those?" The thin-lipped grin spread out. "Continence pants are funny. Of course they are. Unless, of course, you're the one who needs them."
"Fifth aisle. Although, if you stay close to home, you won't need them. Based on your pallor, sir, and the way you're sweating, it might be wiser to do that."
"Thanks," I said, and imagined socking him square in the mouth and knocking his dentures down his throat. "Suck on a little Polident, pal." I shopped slowly, not wanting to joggle my liquefied guts any more than necessary. Got the Kaopectate, large economy size, check. Then the continence pants, adult large, check. The pants were in ostomy supplies between the enema bags and brooding yellow coils of plastic hose whose function I didn't want to know about. There were also adult diapers, but at those I balked. If necessary, I would stuff the continence pants with dish towels. This struck me as funny, and despite my misery, I had to struggle not to laugh. Laughing in my current delicate state might bring on disaster. As if sensing my distress, the skeletal druggist rang up my items in slow motion. I paid him, holding out a $5 bill with a hand that was shaking appreciably.
"Anything else?"
"Just one thing. I'm miserable. You can see I'm miserable, so why the hell are you grinning at me?" Mr. Keene took a step backward, the smile falling from his lips.
"I assure you, I wasn't grinning. I certainly hope you feel better."
My bowels cramped. I staggered a little, grabbing the paper bag with my stuff inside it and holding on to the counter with my free hand.
"Do you have a bathroom?"
The smile reappeared.
"Not for customers, I'm afraid. Why not try one of the establishments across the street?" You're quite the bastard, aren't you? The perfect goddamn dairy citizen. He stiffened, then turned away and stalked into the nether regions where his pills, powders, and syrups were kept. I walked slowly past the soda fountain and out the door. I felt like a man made of glass. The day was cool, no more than 45 degrees, but the sun felt hot on my skin and sticky. My bowels cramped again. I stood stock still for a moment with my head down, one foot on the sidewalk and one in the gutter. The cramp passed. I crossed the street without looking for traffic, and someone honked at me. I restrained myself from flipping the bird at the honker, but only because I had enough trouble. I couldn't risk getting into a fight. I was in one already. The cramp struck again, a double knife to the lower gut. I broke into a run. The sleepy silver dollar was closest, so that was the door I jerked open, hustling my unhappy body into semi-darkness and the yeasty smell of beer. On the jukebox, Conway Twitty was moaning that it was only make-believe. I wished he were right. The place was empty, except for one patron sitting at an empty table, looking at me with startled eyes, and the bartender, leaning at the end of the stick, doing the crossword puzzle in the daily paper. He looked up at me. "Bathroom," I said. "Quick!" He pointed to the back, and I sprinted toward the doors marked buoys and gulls. I straight-armed buoys like a fullback looking for open field to run in. The place stank of shit, cigarette smoke, and eye-watering chlorine. The single toilet stall had no door, which was probably good. I tore my pants open like Superman late for a bank robbery, turned, and dropped. Just in time. When the latest throw had passed, I took the giant bottle of Kaopectate out of the paper bag and chugged three long swallows. My stomach heaved. I fought it back into place. When I was sure the first dose was going to stay down, I slugged another one, belched, and slowly screwed the cap back into place. On the wall to my left, someone had drawn a penis and testicles. The testicles were split open, and blood was gushing from them. Below this charming image, the artist had written, "Henry Castonguay, next time you fuck my wife, this is what you get." I closed my eyes, and when I did, I saw the startled patron who'd watched my charge to the bathroom. But was he a patron? There had been nothing on his table. He had just been sitting there. My eyes closed. I could see that face clearly. It was one I knew. When I went back into the bar, Ferlin Husky had replaced Conway Twitty, and no suspenders was gone. I went to the bartender and said, "There was a guy sitting over there when I came in. Who was it?" He looked up from his puzzle. "I didn't see no one." I took out my wallet, removed a five, and put it on the bar beside a Narragansett coaster. "The name." He held a brief silent dialogue with himself, glanced at the tip jar beside the one holding pickled eggs, saw nothing inside but one lonely dime, and made the five disappear. That was Bill Turkett. The name meant nothing to me. The empty table might mean nothing either, but on the other hand, I put Honest Abe's twin brother on the bar. Did he come in here to watch me? If the answer to that was yes, it meant he'd been following me. Maybe not just today, either. But why? The bartender pushed the five back. "All I know is what he usually comes in for is beer, and a lot of it." "Then why did he leave without having one?" "Maybe he looked in his wallet and didn't see nothing but his library card. Do I look like fucking Brady Murphy? Now that you've stunk up my bathroom, why don't you either order something or leave?" "It was stinking just fine before I got there, my friend." Not much of an exit line, but the best I could do under the circumstances. I went out and stood on the sidewalk looking for Turkett. There was no sign of him. But Norbert Keene was standing in the window of his drugstore, hands clasped behind his back, watching me.
His smile was gone. At 5:20 that afternoon, I parked my Sunliner in the lot adjacent to the Wycham Street Baptist Church. It had plenty of company. According to the signboard, there was a 5 p.m. AA meeting at this particular church. In the Ford's trunk were all the possessions I'd collected during my 7 weeks as a resident of what I had come to think of as the peculiar little city. The only indispensable items were in the Lord Buxton briefcase Al had given me, his notes, my notes, and the remaining cash. Thank God I'd kept most of it in portable form. Beside me on the seat was a paper bag containing my bottle of kaopectate, now 3/4 empty, and the continence pants. Thankfully, I didn't think I was going to need those. My stomach and bowels seemed to have settled, and the shakes had left my hands. There were 6 payday candy bars in the glove compartment, lying on top of my police special. I added these items to the bag. Later, when I was in position between the garage and the hedge at 202 Wymore Lane, I'd load the gun and stuff it into my belt, like a cheap gunsel, in the kind of B-pictures that played the Strand. There was one other item in the glove compartment, an issue of TV Guide with Fred Astaire and Barry Chase on the cover. For probably the 12th time since I'd bought the magazine at the newsstand on Upper Main Street, I turned to the Friday listings. 8 p.m., Channel 2, The New Adventures of Ellery Queen, George Nader, Les Tremaine, So Rich, So Lovely, So Dead. A conniving stockbroker, Whit Bissell, stalks a wealthy heiress, Ava Gabor, as Ellery and his father investigate. I put it in the bag with the other stuff, mostly for good luck, then got out, locked my car, and set out for Wymore Lane. I passed a few mommies and daddies trick-or-treating with children too young to be out on their own. Carved pumpkins grinned cheerfully from many stoops, and a couple of stuffed straw hat-wearing dummies stared at me blankly. I walked down Wymore Lane in the middle of the sidewalk as if I had every right to be there. When a father approached, holding the hand of a little girl wearing dangly gypsy earrings, mom's bright red lipstick, and big black plastic ears clapped over a curly-haired wig, I tipped my hat to Dad and bent down to the child who was carrying a paper bag of her own. "Who are you, honey?" "Annette Funagiello," she said. "She's the prettiest mousketeer." "And you're just as pretty," I told her. "Now, what do you say?" She looked puzzled, so her father leaned over and whispered in her ear. She brightened into a smile. "Trick or treat." "Right," I said, "but no tricks tonight." Except for the one I hope to play on the man with the hammer. I took a payday from my bag. I had to paw past the gun to get it and held it out. She opened her bag and I dropped it in. I was just a guy on the street, a perfect stranger in a town that had been beset by terrible crimes not long ago. But I saw the same childlike trust on the faces of both father and daughter. The days of candy doctored with LSD were far in the future, as were those of "do not use if seal is broken." The father whispered again. "Thank you, mister," Annette Funagiello said. "Very welcome," I winked to Dad. "You two have a great night." "She'll probably have a bellyache tomorrow," Dad said, but he smiled. "Come on, Punkin." "I'm Annette," she said. "Sorry, sorry, come on, Annette." He gave me a grin, tipped his own hat, and they were off again in search of plunder. I continued on to 202, not too fast. I would have whistled if my lips hadn't been so dry. At the driveway, I risked one quick look around. I saw a few trick-or-treaters on the other side of the street, but no one was paying the slightest attention to me. Excellent. I walked briskly up the driveway. Once I was behind the house, I breathed a sigh of relief so deep it seemed to come all the way from my heels. I took up my position. in the far right corner of the backyard, safely hidden between the garage and the hedge. Or so I thought. I peered into the Dunnings' backyard. The bikes were gone. Most of the toys were still there, a child's bow and